This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nicholas de Torrente, was in Afghanistan in August, touring the medical facilities run by Doctors Without Borders, the international humanitarian medical group. He was head of their mission in Afghanistan and several other countries in 1997 and is now the USA executive director of Doctors Without Borders. The group's mission is to provide medical aid wherever it is needed, regardless of race, religion, politics, or sex. After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Doctors Without Borders evacuated its 70 foreign nationals working in Afghanistan, leaving their clinics in the hands of their Afghan staff. How were the people of Doctors Without Borders told that they had to evacuate Afghanistan?
Well, there was a rising of tensions, and the final, we were very reluctant to leave. Obviously, we considered that our place is with the civilian populations, wherever they may be and whoever they may be, and we want to be present in war situations because that's where the victims are. So we were very reluctant to leave. We tried to make arrangements, but in the final event, what happened is that the Taliban authorities themselves told us that they could no longer guarantee the safety and security of our staff. And since we rely on the consent of the authorities to be able to operate, we rely on the fact that we're independent, that we are a humanitarian organization. We're not involved in any way in political issues, in religious issues, and so on. And this, is our guarantee, and usually enables us to operate. But in this case, when it came down to it, we were told that we would have to leave. And reluctantly, we left and we evacuated our 70 international staff who were present throughout the country to neighboring countries where they are trying to continue their work. We maintain a small group in the northeastern part of the country, controlled by the Northern Alliance, and there we still have medical teams.
When the Taliban told Doctors Without Borders that they couldn't guarantee your group's safety, was that code for saying, we're not going to try to protect you anymore. We don't really want you anymore. Get out.
Well, it's there are different interpretations, and we don't really know which one is the correct one at this point. Obviously, there have been radical elements within the Taliban who have felt very uneasy with the presence of foreigners inside the country. As I said, the presence of foreigners is important, we feel, to be able to bear witness to the situation and to be able to stand up on behalf of the population to some of their of the policies, for instance, access of women to healthcare, in our case. There were also, more moderate elements who saw that it was important to have humanitarian operations present, to be able to help the people. I mean, they also have families, they also have children, they also have they have wives and sisters that need health, for instance. So there was a mix, tensions within them as well as to whether we should be able to be allowed to operate. We don't know. I mean, did radical groups intend to, in the event of a military action, take humanitarian groups as hostages, use them as human shields, or did they fear that the population might turn against us? I mean, at this point, we don't know. We were just told that we had to go.
Were there certain Taliban regulations that you had to operate under in Afghanistan, regulating, for instance, the kind of treatment that women could receive, or what women doctors from Doctors Without Borders were or were not allowed to do? Were women doctors allowed to practice at all?
Yes, there were regulations and there were constraints, and that's the sort of the space that we were trying to preserve at all costs. I mean, for us, we had a series of sort of bottom line conditions to be able to continue to work there and to make sure that we were making a positive difference. Those were, for instance, that women patients could come freely to our clinics, or the clinics we were supporting, that Afghan female staff, medical doctors, nurses, nursing assistants, and so on, would be allowed to work with us. And at times we really had to fight to make sure that that would be the case. There was a big attempt a few years ago to completely segregate, for instance, healthcare, and to have women-only hospitals with women staff in them. And the Taliban tried to impose this too. And we felt that that would result in a reduction of access and make it more difficult for women to have access to healthcare. So we fought against that, and we were able to maintain integrated structures where there you have men working and female staff working as well. This is a continuous struggle, and it was and one where we had doubts and questions, and we were questioning the effect of our actions constantly, as we do in other countries. But we felt, the bottom line was that we were helping people, that we were helping Afghan medical staff by being there. We were enabling them to stay in their country. A lot of them have already left. There's been a huge brain drain out of Afghanistan, and we were having a positive impact, even though it was very difficult.
When you say that you were questioning yourself, do you mean you were wondering whether your presence was bolstering the Taliban ideology?
I mean, I think it's a responsible thing to do, and we try to do this in every context to really assess, how beneficial our impact is, because of course in one sense you could argue that humanitarian agencies, not only ourselves but everyone, by being present was enabling the Taliban, for instance, not to deal with the needs of their people and to put resources into fighting the war, or it was helping them gain legitimacy towards their own population. And given the type of regime it is, of course, we had these concerns. But as I said, we are a humanitarian aid is a very pragmatic endeavor, and it really seeks to help people and to help them get through a very difficult phase in their lives. And we felt that we were able to do that, including for the most vulnerable people in the country, including for women and children, and that we were, and that on balance was much more important.
Did the women doctors at Doctors Without Borders have to dress or behave in a certain way? Did they have to wear, body veils in order to work?
As is the case in any Islamic country, they had to wear a scarf over their head, covering clothing. They had to, that was. But that's a concession that we make, and we make respectfully so to countries in which we are, in which we work, everywhere in the Islamic world.
On your last trip to Afghanistan, you visited camps in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. Were you seeing more and more refugees crossing the border into Pakistan?
Yes, we've seen over the past year an increased flow of refugees coming out of Afghanistan into Pakistan. And there they are joining many others, approximately 2 million others, who have been Afghan refugees who have been there for a number of years, some over 10 years. And the Afghan refugees who have been there for a long time are settled in camps that resemble villages with mud houses, and they've integrated into the Pakistani society and economy. Whereas the new incomers have been put into camps that are very makeshift, that are in very severe conditions, very harsh conditions, under tents, and purposefully kept in that situation, because there's been a growing tension between the Pakistani authorities and population of the border areas and the Afghan refugee population, and therefore Pakistan is quite uncomfortable with the prospect of having to have more refugees come into the country, and therefore even assistance to these new refugees was very difficult. We had to really pry the door open and to get access and to be able to do the basic medical services that we do in any refugee situation, such as vaccinating against measles, setting up a health clinic, providing emergency water. There was a camp called Jalazai Camp, which is the one that was a lot in the news, and this camp was very bleak indeed. And as we talk now of of a new influx, I think it's important to bear in mind this this underlying reluctance of Pakistan because of this the growing difficulties of hosting Afghan refugees and the large numbers of them already there in welcoming new refugees, and how difficult it's going to be able to provide assistance and to be able to protect these refugees who are often from different ethnic groups than the ones who are already there inside Pakistan. And this is a very difficult situation that we're trying to address now by scaling up our operations in Pakistan and in Iran.
Why don't you describe the conditions in the camp that you just mentioned?
Well, the camp is a moon-like landscape. Nothing grows in that area. It's an area where no crops are possible. And on this very harsh terrain, refugees have set up small little tents. They're regrouped very, closely regrouped together. There's a high population density in that camp. And they are controlled by the Pakistani authorities, who've been reluctant to give them refugee status. So they have difficulties in getting access to the job market, in doing things to fend for themselves. And so they've been very much dependent on aid that we've been able to provide from the outside. And that's been water, that's been medical services, nutritional services. But they're in a limbo, really, in a very precarious situation.
From what I've heard and read, it certainly sounds like the refugee camps in Pakistan during the war between Afghanistan and the Soviets were very radicalizing places. I mean, my understanding mm-hmm. is that a lot of the Taliban came out of the refugee camps in Pakistan, where they learned a very radical form of Islam. And I'm wondering if you think that the refugee camps still are radicalizing places.
Well, the refugee camps were, at the time, were in effect sanctuaries for Afghan civilians, but not only for Afghan civilians, but also for the Mujahideen fighting groups that were then being supplied there, supported there, and then were fighting inside the country. This was during the time of the resistance to the Soviet invasion, and that is what carried over into the 90s, even as the Soviets withdrew in the late 80s. Currently, the situation is a bit different for these new arrivals. These are really mainly civilians. These are really mainly people fleeing violence, persecution inside Afghanistan, and fleeing the effects of the drought. And as I said, they live in such difficult conditions that it's hard to see the kind of organization, the kind of structure, the kind of takeover by militant groups that we have seen among the older and more established camps in the past.
My guest is Nicholas de Torrente, USA Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas de Torrente of Doctors Without Borders. Last month, he toured the group's medical facilities in Afghanistan. Have the doctors at Doctors Without Borders had a difficult time working with Afghan women under the Taliban? And by that I mean, have Afghan women become so fearful and self-conscious under the Taliban that they're afraid to openly discuss their medical problems or afraid to have a doctor examine their bodies?
What we've seen, in fact, and it's quite interesting, is to see that how health structures have become places, some of the only places in Afghan society under the Taliban, where women were allowed to go. And so it became a kind of social, there was a social aspect to the health centers. Women were allowed to go there. They could remove their burqa, their veil. They could talk to each other. They could talk to outsiders. This is some of the only places where Afghan women could talk to people from abroad, international medical staff of women doctors, women nurses. And so it became a place for exchange and exchange and for social communication, where they could talk about their much broader grievances and their problems of everyday life, and they could exchange and support each other. So there was a social function to the health centers as well, not only a medical one, and that's why we felt it was so important to have these health structures continue, and to have women doctors from abroad and women nurses from abroad be in contact with Afghan women, because they're the only ones who could do that.
Were there Taliban guards at the Doctors Without Borders clinics to make sure that the Taliban code was being enforced at all times?
There were certainly attempts by certain groups of Taliban, in particular the religious police, to come in at, and it was not a constant thing, but they would come in at times and just check to make sure that nothing that they considered to be inappropriate was going on within the structures, to make sure that there were male medical staff would not be talking to Afghan female patients and so on, or that the male staff and the female staff were not talking to each other and interacting, and so they would do that. It was harsher in certain areas, such as Kabul. It was better in others, such as Mazar-e-Sharif. It depended a little bit. It depended on the way the religious police, the local commander, how he was feeling about it, and it depended on the time period. It was not a constant thing, but yes, there was a policing in force by the Taliban on these aspects.
Humanitarian agencies in Afghanistan were reporting this week that the Taliban seized about 1,400 tons of food. What have you heard about that?
Well, we know that there's increasing pressure on the remaining humanitarian programs that are run by Afghan national staff inside Afghanistan now that the international staff has withdrawn. And this is not surprising. The presence of international staff is really the guarantee, or at least the attempt to guarantee that that aid is going to the right people and is used in the right way. We're not surprised that this type of developments are happening. We have a hard time communicating with our staff inside Afghanistan, so we don't really know to what extent our own programs are affected. But we've had the request by the Taliban to hand over medical supplies, and the ARCH staff has not had much of a choice in that matter. Under the current circumstances, so I think it's not surprising that there is that there are increasing attempts by the Taliban to take over what is remaining of the humanitarian programs and infrastructure there. And that's why it's so important that we're able to resume operations with international volunteers and staff, so that they can see what's going on, and they can stand up to the authorities.
Is there anything that you think you could tell us that might help explain some of what we've been witnessing? Because you've been in Afghanistan, because you've been in Pakistan, you've been a witness to a lot of events there, a witness to how a lot of people are feeling. Any thoughts you want to leave us with that might help us understand some of the motivation behind the attack?
I can't really speak to that. But I think what I bring back from Afghanistan is the sense that people there, as in anywhere in the world, and as here in the United States as well, are looking for a decent life for their families. They're struggling to be safe. They're struggling to be able to feed their children and to provide for their education. I think there's the basic humanity that you see when you go to Afghanistan, and the immense pressures this population has been under from forces that are really outside of most of their of the control of most of them. I bring back the sense that we should not forget that, and we should continue to see the human aspect and the human face in in people, even though they're very far away, even though the situation is very complex, even though it's somehow difficult to understand what is going on there, especially as we are reeling here under the shock of what has happened and struggling to find answers. But I would really urge us to continue to build bridges with what is the same there as is here, the human element.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck in your travels around the world.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nicholas de Torrente is Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.